I think the words that the engineer used was he's perplexed. There was no indication of any wear.
The state ferry dock in Skagway sinks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, South Central Foundation reaches a nearly $100 million settlement with the IHS.
We're all kind of a little bit walking still, like we're in a dream, knowing that it's not a dream anymore.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Doy Unlimited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The state ferry dock in Skagway remains underwater and is closed indefinitely. The dock was completely submerged by about 9:30 this morning, and yellow absorbent boom was laid around it. State transportation engineers have been on site and are still assessing the damage. Agency spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says the dock is resting on the seafloor and is fully submerged at high tide and partially submerged during low tide. Skagway resident Gary Hager was one of the first to see it this morning. He says the tugboat Anna T was tied up on the east side of the dock and the west side was underwater. When the tug untied from the dock, the rest of the dock sunk.
Last night about 5:30, they had a forklift on the dock and everything was fine. So nobody's really sure what happened this morning, but it was a surprise.
DOT engineers were surprised, too. Woodrow says the 160 by 120-foot dock is made of 24 individual concrete chambers.
I think the words that the engineer used was he's perplexed. And we actually have inspected every single one of those individual chambers in the last year, and there was no indication of any wear.
No ferries are scheduled into Skagway today. The Alaska Marine Highway System has canceled all sailings for the next 2 weeks. Woodrow says if the dock can be salvaged, it will take some time before it will be ready to accept ferry traffic. Anchorage-based South Central Foundation announced a settlement with the Indian Health Service over contract payments that at $96 million represents the largest IHS settlement in history. Lloyd Miller is one of the attorneys who brought suit against the IHS on behalf of tribes. Miller says after the U.S. Supreme Court in 2005 ruled the federal government was liable for underfunding tribal contracts, tribes filed hundreds of suits. But the IHS still refused to pay or settle until the Supreme Court reaffirmed their ruling in 2012.
That signaled the beginning of a long and very arduous settlement process, because by late 2012, the agency was facing claims by over 200 tribes and intertribal organizations, totaling in excess of $2 billion.
Miller says no claims were settled until 2013, but he says over the last 3 or 4 months, the logjam of disagreement over how to proceed with settlements has broken. Other payments in Alaska have happened in recent weeks, and Miller says the Yukon-Kuskokwim settlement in December was the second largest in history behind South Central.
Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation settled in December for $39 million, and also settlements have been achieved for the Manilik Corporation, the Ketchikan Indian Corporation, the Arctic Slope Native Association, and the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation. All of those have now been resolved, and there are many more in active negotiations right now.
Miller says the money will have great impact for Alaska tribes. Catherine Gottlieb is the president and CEO of South Central Foundation. She says signing the agreement was a relief.
We're all kind of a little bit walking still, like we're in a dream, knowing that it's not a dream anymore, and we actually achieved our goals and received the funds from the federal government.
Does this signal a new era in government-to-government relationships with the federal government that in the past have been sort of paternalistic? Are we seeing a new relationship now between tribes and the federal government?
We did fight for this. And I think the negotiations came through the fight and the agreements, and they still need to fund fully 100% the amounts necessary for health care. And this obligation that was met was a contract support cost shortfall. It was a shortfall. It does not meet the obligation that Congress still has, or the government still has, with tribes and across the nation. So we're still, many of the tribes are still 50% below funding. And Alaska's between 50 and 70%, somewhere like that. But we are all still underfunded for healthcare delivery. So my hope with this administration is they keep continuing going forward in what they have done. They are moving towards fulfilling contractual obligations. And I have a huge better outlook. I feel like there's light at the end of the tunnel.
But it sounds like you can't just sit back and say, whew, I can relax now. The fight, there's still a lot of work to be done, and the pressure has to kind of stay on the federal government. Is that fair?
Oh, absolutely. It still has to stay until all the contracts are signed with all the tribes. And then when we're done with that, hopefully they'll be continuing, or as we're completing that, more funding will come for the other 50% of healthcare needs that are out there by the tribes.
What does this mean for South Central Foundation to have finally this settlement and this $96 million? Do you have thoughts about how South Central will use this amount of money now?
South Central Foundation plans 20 years in advance, so we have many unfulfilled needs that we have not completed or taken action on because of the shortfall. We've been using our program funds to fund many programs that are needed, and we'll be able to fill that gap. But also our board has plans of looking at the funds and making sure that they're used wisely for sustainability. We're looking, remember, not at our children, but our next generations to come. This is not a program that we're in just for 10 years or 20 years. It's actually for the lifetime of our children's children.
Catherine Gottlieb is the president and CEO of South Central Foundation. The healthcare consortium serves 60,000 Native people. Negotiators from the State House and Senate have reached a deal on the governor's education bill, and it includes a mix of permanent and one-time funding increases. The compromise was announced last night, 3 days after the legislature blew through its deadline because of disagreement on the bill. The conference committee in charge of rewriting the legislation has decided to add $300 million to the education budget, spread out over 3 years. Senator Kevin Meyer is an Anchorage Republican who is involved in the negotiations. He says that even if the compromise seems obvious now, it was not so clear on Sunday when the legislature was facing its adjournment deadline.
Well, you know, I think it took a couple days to realize that, actually, that there's an easy solution here. So sometimes it just takes a couple days and then you go, wow, why didn't we think of that?
The funding plan still does not meet the demands of education advocates. The conference committee was expected to advance the bill today on this 94th day of the 90-day session, but still has not sent the legislation to the full House and Senate. Less than 2 hours after the combative House and Senate seemed to reach a truce on education, a bill dealing with the proposed Kinnick Arm Bridge fell apart on the House floor. The House rejected the Senate's version by one vote last night. Because 21 votes are required to pass legislation, the bill came up short when it got 20 yeas and 18 nays. 6 Republicans broke ranks with their party to oppose the bill. While the bill originated in the House, it was dramatically changed in the Senate after an audit suggested the project may be uneconomic. A new version sets up a financing plan for the billion-dollar bridge that involves a mix of federal highway grants, federal loans, and state bonds. Because the House failed to concur, the bill has been sent to a free conference committee with the power to rewrite it, just as was done with the education bill this week. The decision to go to conference on the Kinnick Arm Bridge could extend a legislative session that has already gone 4 days over its statutory deadline. The bridge bill is a major priority of Senate President Charlie Huggins, a Wasilla Republican. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Petersburg prepares for a busy tourist season.
It looks like it's going to be a better year for us. We're seeing a great increase in the number of independent visitors.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
The Coast Guard has finished investigating a Bering Sea rescue that left a 28-year-old crewman with fatal head injuries late last year. According to a review board, faulty equipment and work practices developed by the crew of the cutter Weishi put Petty Officer Travis Obendorf in harm's way. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
Obendorf and the rest of the Weishi crew had been on patrol in the Bering Sea for 3 months when they were called to help the Alaska Mist. It was a large fishing vessel that lost propulsion and started drifting near Aimak Island. The Weishi reached the fishing boat on Veterans Day, November 11th. Coast Guard Public Affairs Officer Allison Conroy says the situation was urgent.
They had 22 mariners on board. They were disabled, and the Coast Guard needed to get the non-essential personnel off of the Alaska Mist.
Although they had access to a helicopter, Conroy says the Weishi crew wanted to send their rescue boat to pick up the fishermen. It's a 24-foot inflatable Zodiac with hard sides. Conroy says the crew conducted a risk assessment of their rescue plan.
They had already done so many small boat operations in the environment that they were in on November 11th that they were more concerned about rescuing these people, and they were comfortable with conducting the operations.
The Weishi had used their small boat 130 times during their patrol in the Bering Sea. It always went smoothly, except for the fact that the boat launch and recovery system was broken. The system was a capture net and a line designed to snag the rescue boat when the crew steered it back into a compartment at the rear of the cutter. The system was supposed to secure the vessel without any human intervention. But on the Weishi, it only worked about 40% of the time. The other two national security cutters also had problems, but not as consistently. Conroy, the Coast Guard's public affairs officer, says the cutters formally requested improvements to their small boat capture system about 4 years ago.
The safety implications were not evident at that particular time. Of course, retrospectively, the changes were incorrectly prioritized among numerous high-priority configuration change projects.
In the meantime, the Weishi decided to work around it. Conroy says they started posting a crew member at the very front of the small rescue boat. That person would manually secure the vessel after a mission. It wasn't common practice, but it worked, until it was time to rescue the Alaska Mist. Petty Officer Travis Obendorf, a 28-year-old Idaho native, was assigned to sit at the front of the rescue boat. They gathered five non-essential fishermen off the Alaska Mist and started to take them back to the Coast Guard cutter. According to the Coast Guard's investigation report, they faced rough seas, worse than what the rescue boat was rated to operate in, that made it hard to steer back into the compartment aboard the Weishi. The rescue boat was halfway inside when a series of swells washed in behind it. The boat slid underneath the capture net, and the net shoved Obendorf backwards. He was slammed into the center console of the rescue boat and lost consciousness. Obendorf had been wearing a helmet, but he still had severe head injuries. A medical crew aboard the Weishi responded as soon as possible, and Conroy says they called for a medevac.
He was then medically evacuated from the Weishi and taken to Cold Bay. From Cold Bay, he was taken to Anchorage. After Anchorage, he was then transported to Seattle for continued care. And then on December 18th, he died in a Seattle hospital.
Conroy says the Coast Guard started making changes to its national security cutters almost immediately after Obendorf was injured. They got rid of the rescue boat that the Weishi crew had been using and replaced it with a slightly larger model.
There's also been guidance put out that commanding officers are not to put any crewman forward of the center console, which is what happened in the incident with Petty Officer Obendorf.
Conroy says that within a few months, there shouldn't be a need to put crew members in that position anymore. The Coast Guard is going to fix its system for launching and recovering rescue boats from cutters, so it's fully automatic. The repairs are similar to what the National Security Cutters asked for back in 2010, and Conroy says that fact has prompted the Coast Guard to rethink the way they prioritize upgrades to their fleet.
they are taking a closer look at the recommendations that are coming in from the field and specifically looking to see if they have a safety aspect and reevaluating those recommendations.
In the end, Conroy says the Coast Guard is not taking any disciplinary action against personnel connected to the rescue operation or the accident. And Conroy says there haven't been any lawsuits related to it either. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
GCI is facing a lawsuit filed by customers along the Kuskokwim River in western Alaska. KYUK's Shane Iverson has more.
The complaint was filed in the Bethel Courthouse on Tuesday, April 22nd, by the Law Office of Jim Valcarcy and the Law Office of David Henderson. Henderson says the allegations against GCI are over their data plans and cell phone service.
They've made them buy the data services, and they haven't provided what they've promised. And the second thing is they've promised to deliver reliable cell phone services, and people have paid for those services, and they haven't delivered in reliable cell phone services as well.
There are four plaintiffs currently listed, including Mary Pete, Robert Sundown, William Howell, and Linda Kwame. They allege GCI has been advertising their 3G network in rural Alaska, and specifically the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, regardless of the fact that their smartphone and data plans were not supported by sufficient infrastructure. The suit alleges GCI's data almost never works and that dropped call rates are frequently between 50% and 100%. Henderson says he's trying to turn the lawsuit into a class action suit that could affect many people in the YK Delta.
We've had immense interest in the lawsuit. We are asking that this be certified as a class action. That class action will encompass the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and all the people that have bought cell phone services within that geographical area.
GCI did not return a request for comment by airtime. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Members of the Alaska Food Policy Council hosted a town hall meeting in Bethel to gather information they'll use to guide statewide food policy. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Bethel community members gather around tables at a local cafe to brainstorm ideas about how the food system in the YK Delta could be better.
Break up into two or three small groups and pick one or two different issues.
Subsistence hunting and fishing, along with gardening and farming, were noted as strengths in the YK Delta, while high prices at grocery stores and problems finding places to process and store food were among problems discussed. The Alaska Food Policy Council is an independent statewide advocacy group with a vision for a food-secure, healthy Alaska. Partners include the state of Alaska and nonprofits, among others. AFPC board member Gary Ferguson says one of the council's main goals is to make healthy food more available and affordable.
Alaska is very dependent upon outside food. Over 95% of our food comes from outside of the state of Alaska, so less than 5% is locally grown. And we spend a lot of money on food. We need to look at having more of that money being sourced locally. And also it provides an economic base, you know, it provides jobs, it provides more nutrient-dense foods as well.
Food Bank of Alaska officials say that 14% of people are food insecure in the state. In rural Alaska, those numbers are higher. Studies show that in the Bethel census area, nearly 30% of children don't know where their next meal's coming from. Food insecurity is defined as not having enough access to food in socially acceptable ways. Bethel Cooperative Extension Director Leif Albertson participated in the town hall. He says lack of local community processing facilities was a major barrier to food security discussed in his group.
It's hard to have local food because there's so many barriers to processing, sort of hoops you have to jump through, things like commercial kitchens or standards of practice for processing foods that really are cost prohibitive for small producers in rural areas.
Bethel farmer Tim Meyer says many people in his group discussed expanding farming in Bethel as an opportunity.
Well, a local solution would be growing a lot of food. I mean, I think we have the ability to grow a tremendous amount of food. In fact, I think we could grow enough food to feed the majority of the state. We just need to try some different techniques about getting that type of a system going.
Town hall meetings were already held in Nome, Juneau, and Fairbanks. Additional meetings are planned for Anchorage, Palmer, and Homer in the fall. The information gathered at the town hall meetings will be used by the council to inform institutions, organizations, and policymakers. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Three rarely seen whales beached on Alaska's coast last year, and NOAA Fisheries is investigating whether human activity contributed to the strandings. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
The Steinegger's beaked whales beached last fall, one on St. Lawrence Island and two in Valdez. Neither of those places are where Steinegger's are usually found, and each animal showed indication of trauma.
They had bubbles of air within the blood vessels. And this is true in all the cases, so animals in Valdez and also the animal up in the St. Lawrence Island area. You know, this is just a classic lesion that you see when there's an animal that suffered from barotrauma.
That's Dr. Kathy Barrett-Cunnington with the Alaska Veterinary Pathologist Service. She performed the necropsies on the whales. Huntington says barotrauma is like the bends in humans, often caused by rising too quickly to the surface from a deep dive. But Steinegger's are built for deep dives. They're usually found over a half mile below the water.
They should have certain behaviors that allow them to avoid that kind of situation if they're acting normally.
Loud noises can send the whales rocketing to the surface, and seismic activity can also damage barriers within the whales' bodies, between gas-filled areas and the bloodstream. Both situations can cause this trauma.
For example, if there's blasting going on in an area, underwater blasting, that can create this kind of thing. It's thought that really high-intensity sonar is another possibility.
Beaked whales' tendency for deep dives makes their presence in the shallow waters of the Bering Straits region and Valdez unusual. Alaria Jensen is the NOAA Fisheries Marine Mammal Stranding Coordinator for the Alaska region. She says beachings occur for many reasons, like disease entanglement and ship collisions, but no evidence of those conditions appear in these whales.
So it leads us back to the gas bubbles pointing towards some kind of acoustic trauma. So we want to see what was going on in the area during that time.
NOAA Fisheries is investigating the cause of the strandings and if noise from human activity contributed. Huntington says there were reports of seismic activity in Valdez in the area of the beaching, but the investigation is ongoing. Reporting from Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
More tourists are expected to visit Petersburg this summer than in recent years. The small town cannot accommodate large cruise ships, but that's just the sort of thing some visitors are looking for. KFSK's Angela Denning reports.
It's tough to put an exact number on how many tourists come to Petersburg every year, but it's definitely in the thousands. The closest figure might be from the Alaska Visitor Statistics Program, which shows about 14,000 came in 2011. That number includes visitors by plane, cruise ship, and ferry. Dave Berg has operated Viking Travel Incorporated in Petersburg for 31 years.
It looks like it's going to be a better year for us. We're seeing a great increase in the number of independent visitors than we've seen in the past.
Independent travelers is an industry term that means people who visit on their own outside of large cruise ships.
Most of the time they have Petersburg as part of an overall Alaska experience.
The phone lines in Berg's office are busy these days. He's dealing with people from all over the world. He says the increase in tourists is partly due to his business buying out Alaska Ferry Adventures and Homer. They were doing the same line of work, setting up travel packages for visitors. He's now trying to get those people to come to Petersburg. The main local draw is whale watching. There are also kayak trips, the Bella Vista Garnet Mine, and the nearby Anan Bear Observatory. But Berg says it doesn't have to be that adventurous. People just appreciate walking around the harbors and talking to fishermen.
Just the small town atmosphere, the village that we have, the village feel of Petersburg versus places with the large cruise ships. There's a big difference in the experience that people have by coming to small towns.
The independent traveler loves Petersburg.
Marilyn Menish-Muchi runs the Petersburg Visitors Information Center.
All the businesses here are locally owned. The only chain we have that's a national chain is Wells Fargo. And so that is huge to people, because every time they buy an item in this town, it stays in the, you know, the money stays in this town.
Manish Muchi says keeping it local is not only good for attracting tourists, but also for the local businesses. Petersburg's Chamber of Commerce director Cindy Lagadakis agrees.
There's more fuel sales. The gift shops see an increased business and I think some pretty steady clientele in the summertime from independent travelers. The food businesses certainly see an uptick, and in part that's why, you know, some businesses are only open in the summertime, is we have more people coming through town and can support those additional businesses, and those dollars, you know, flow through town.
It didn't hurt that Yachting Magazine recently designated Petersburg as one of the best small towns in the country to visit.
So we've had a lot of people calling on the phone asking more questions about what Petersburg's like, what we have to offer, questions about our harbors, and some really increased interest in what we have to offer here in Petersburg.
Petersburg has about 3,000 residents. Lagadakis says it's often the small town charm that visitors are after.
What I hear again and again from folks that are visitors to town is how friendly the community is. And I think in part it's because we don't have so many people. There's enough new people, but not so many that you feel bombarded by it. And people will say hi to people in the street, or they will offer to help you find something or tell you a little bit about why they like Petersburg. And it makes it a very desirable place to visit and to live.
Petersburg's tourist season runs roughly from May 15th to September 15th. This year, there will be one large ship, the Caledonian Sky, which is scheduled to be here twice, but won't be able to dock at the harbors because of its size. It carries about 150 passengers and will have to anchor out in Scow Bay or Frederick Sound. A Gold Rush theme ship is scheduled to be here 12 times. Last year, it came up twice. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, Doug Smith in Skagway, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Shane Iverson and Dacia Eaton in Bethel, Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with former Google Energy Policy Executive Dan Riker on Friday, May 2nd during the 2014 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dena Center. Hear how Alaska can become a world leader in the fast-growing renewable energy industry. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.